Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today. We hear a lot about misinformation, a little bit of it. In the New York Times, a recent sex ed quiz that they published post-Roe, trying to see if their readers could answer some basic questions about pregnancy, about miscarriage, some of the issues that concern those who, well, they've been advocating for abortion for a long time, and some of them take a rather doomsday position when it comes to the fall of Roe. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about the sex ed quiz in the New York Times, Dr. Donna Harrison. She's a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, executive director of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She's associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute and author of a column for The Federalist titled OBGYN Fact Checks New York Times Sex Ed Quiz Finds Numerous Errors. Dr. Harrison, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Chip.
Overall, how do you grade last week's New York Times sex ed quiz?
Well, boy, it's hard to grade it without knowing why, what was their purpose. And I sort of wonder if some of their purpose was to confuse people about what an ectopic is, what an abortion is, what a miscarriage is. So rather than clarifying, some of the way that they wrote the questions was actually very confusing and didn't have a correct answer possible.
The quiz asked one question. Doctors generally start counting pregnancy from what point? How did it answer that question?
Well, I don't know how it answered the question, but the correct answer is doctors count pregnancy from the day the woman started her last menstrual period. And that's because this is a long, 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 long tradition, way before we had ultrasound, way before we had pregnancy tests. So the physical sign that a woman was pregnant was that she stopped having periods. So the last date that we could put a number to was the first day of her last menstrual period.
How did the quiz do on questions regarding pregnancy, vasectomies, tubal ligations?
Well, they ask a question about what's the most effective form of male birth control, but then they didn't give the correct answer. The most effective form of male birth control is vasectomy. I was kind of surprised in why they would ask that question and not give a correct answer. As far as Plan B, now it's very interesting. They only gave 3 possible answers. And what they wanted to do, what this question seems to want to do, is to have people say, oh, Plan B doesn't cause an abortion. But the issue about how does it work is actually it depends on where you are in your period when you take the Plan B. If you take it 2 to 4 days before you release an egg, and that's mid-cycle, then Plan B can delay the release of that egg. But if you take it just 1 day before egg release, Plan B can interfere with a signal from your brain to your ovary, which tells your body to make progesterone. And it can interfere with the development of the lining of her womb if taken on that day before egg release. If you take it after egg release, Plan B doesn't appear to do anything. So, again, I have to ask this question, why did they ask this question about Plan B? And the implication is that they sort of want people to think, well, Plan B is fine to use because it prevents ovulation, but that's not the whole story. And in fact, Plan B itself is not really the issue. Plan B is one of a kind of drug called an emergency contraceptive, but the other drug that's used for emergency contraception is something called Ella or Ulipristal. And Ella is a second-generation Mifeprex. It's a second-generation abortion drug. So everyone who's arguing for abortion says, oh, well, emergency contraception can't cause abortion. But what they're not saying is there is a kind of emergency contraception that is exactly the same kind of drug as the abortion pill. So we have to be very careful with questions about contraception because it depends on what contraceptive drug they're talking about. They have different mechanisms of action.
Is it that they were oversimplifying the question and the answers, or were they actually getting the answers wrong?
Well, you know, I can't get into the mind of the people that wrote the quiz, but I find it just very interesting that some of the common misperceptions they perpetuate. Like, for example, the difference between an abortion and a miscarriage. Well, it's very simple. If the baby's dead, then the woman's miscarried. If the baby's alive and you're purposefully killing that baby, that's an elective abortion. It's very simple. And the differentiation between those two is also simple. You get an ultrasound. If the baby has a heartbeat and is alive and there's no medical reason to separate that mom and baby, then if you separate, that is an elective abortion. And if the baby is dead, then you've miscarried. So it's really clear, and it has actually been amazing the amount of misinformation and fear-mongering that's gone on in the media saying, oh, wow, women can't have miscarriage treatment now. It's completely ridiculous. I'm familiar with the laws in this country pertaining to abortion. Not one single law in any state forbids a woman from having miscarriage treatment or forbids a woman from having treatment for an ectopic or forbids a woman from being separated from the baby when her life is immediately at risk. So that's the fact, and it is kind of amazing the amount of misinformation that's out there and what appears to be purposeful confusion so that people won't look at the real issue. And the real issue is, what is an elective-induced abortion? Because that's what the debate's about. It's about the purposeful killing of a living human being in the womb for no medical reason.
Why do they want to blur the line? And this has been especially prevalent since the Dobbs decision, this blurring of the line both morally and medically between miscarriage and abortion, to basically say they're exactly the same thing.
They're not exactly the same thing, and they're differentiated by whether the baby's alive or dead. And that's a very simple thing. And I think the reason they want to blur this line is because they don't want to talk about the fact that an elective-induced abortion is done specifically for the purpose of producing a dead baby. That's exactly the product that you pay an abortionist to produce. You don't pay an abortionist to save a mother's life. You pay an OB-GYN to save a mother's life. And if we as OB-GYNs have to separate a mom and a baby because the mom is not going to survive, if the baby is able to survive outside, there's no problem. You separate the mom and the baby under circumstances where both can get the best care and both can have a chance to live. But sometimes we do have to separate moms and babies before the baby can live outside the womb for situations where she would die if she's not separated from the baby. So under those circumstances, we have a choice as an OB-GYN. We can lose two patients, i.e. the mom and the baby die, or we can separate the mom and the baby, knowing that the baby will die, but at least the mom will live. But we separate that baby under circumstances where the baby is as intact as possible so the mom can hold that baby, so that the mom can be a mom, and the mom and dad can grieve, and the brothers and sisters can grieve. We treat that human being in the womb with the respect that human beings deserve, and we treat the parents as parents. So it's a very different approach when you're doing a separation to save the mother's life, because you want to bring the optimum outcome for that mom, versus when you're intentionally going in with the direct purpose of killing that baby. Now, one thing I want to underline here, if a baby lives after an elective-induced abortion, that's called a failed abortion. The separation of the mom and the baby didn't fail. What failed to occur is that the baby failed to die. So this is actually the nut of the issue. The abortion industry does not want to talk about what an elective-induced abortion actually is. So they're blurring the line between miscarriage and abortion because people are confused about that. They are blurring the line between ectopic pregnancy and abortion. Treating an ectopic pregnancy has nothing to do with treating an abortion. So an ectopic pregnancy is where the embryo has implanted outside of the mom's womb, And you do have to separate that baby from that mom, or else both will die. So those circumstances, they're difficult. But again, it's the issue of what's the purpose of doing the separation procedure. And I think now is a wonderful time for the whole country to start honing in on what is actually being talked about. And the issue is elective-induced abortion.
How common or rare, conversely, is the situation where an OBGYN has to separate the baby from the mother to save the life of the mother?
Well, it's not incredibly common, but all of us pro-life OBGYNs have been there. There's two things that we see in our practice, in training and in our practice. And one of them is when the mom's bag of water breaks, her membranes rupture, before the baby can live outside. And in those circumstances, if we watch and wait, sometimes the mom can reseal those membranes. And sometimes the baby can go on and continue to live and make it to the point of where it can live outside. But many times, the mom starts to get infected. And once the mom starts to get infected, we have no choice. We either lose one or we lose both. So when an infection sets in that circumstance, then we have to separate. And every one of us have been there. And the other circumstance that we see sometimes in some people is what's called severe preeclampsia, which is hypertension. And if that happens before the baby is able to survive outside the womb, which is, it's not common at all, but we've all seen it, all of us in training, then we do have to separate the mom and the baby because there's no treatment for it and the mom can die. Now, there are a handful of other fairly rare conditions that will require separating the mom and baby. So, for example, if the mom gets in an automobile accident at 16 weeks and starts to bleed, we're going to have to stop the bleeding, and that requires separating the mom and the baby. But yes, we've seen them. They're terribly tragic. If we could save the baby, we would. All the time, if the baby is before 22 weeks, we just don't have the technology yet to be able to save the baby.
How did the New York Times quiz do on the difference between an embryo and a fetus?
Well, they did okay. I mean, the embryonic stage, what you got to understand is that there isn't really a difference between an embryo and a fetus. It's like saying, well, what's the difference between a toddler and a four-year-old? They're different stages of the same being. So that's one thing that people may not understand, is that there is a human being present in the mom's womb from the time of sperm-egg membrane fusion. So when I say the womb, I'm including the tube here. So fertilization, where the sperm and the egg meet, happens in the tube. And then it's about a week later that that embryo plants itself inside the mom's womb. And then there's one continuous existence from that point through birth, through toddlerhood, through adolescence. We're all that same being. We don't go through and suddenly become a human being at birth. 4 inches of skin doesn't make the difference between what isn't a human being and what is a human being. So the only thing I would say about the quiz is that there's an implication here that there is some kind of a bright line difference between an embryo and a fetus, and there really isn't. It's a stage of pregnancy, but we go through many stages in our life. The embryonic stage and the fetal stage are just stages of our life.
How do you evaluate the quiz's answers, and you mentioned this a little bit before, on the most effective forms of birth control for both women and men?
Well, like I said before, the question on the most effective form of birth control for men is actually inaccurate, because the most effective form of male birth control is vasectomy. That's where the man's connection between his testicles and the fluid that comes out, that is severed. Okay, it's the spermatic cord, it's severed. That's the most effective form of male birth control. For the female, the effectiveness really depends on how you're asking the question. So let me give an example. If you ask for what's the effectiveness of the combined hormonal contraceptive pill, it will depend on whether you're talking a perfect use or whether you're talking normal use. There have been several studies looking at how many women perfectly use the pill. That means you take it at the same time every day and you never miss a pill. And very few women take it perfectly. So with normal use, you've got a different effectiveness than with perfect use. And it depends on the pill. So progesterone-only pills have a lesser effectiveness than a pill that has two different kinds of an estrogen and a progestin. So again, it's how you ask the question. And the other issue is there's a big push for the use of IUDs. When you evaluate what kind of birth control you're going to select, if you're going to select any, then one of the questions, at least for those who care about embryonic human life, one of the questions is, if I get pregnant, what happens to the embryo that's conceived? And I'm going to tell you a big secret. Every form of birth control has a failure rate. Every single one of them, even vasectomy and tubal ligation. Now, it may be small, but it's real. So for those who care about embryonic life, you have to ask the question, if I'm using this particular form of birth control and I fail, I'm one of those, one of 1,000 or one of 100 or one of 50, what happens to that embryo? So that is a different question than what's the effectiveness. So the question for an IUD, for example, an IUD clearly prevents a embryo from implanting in the womb. And if the embryo is already implanted, it aborts that embryo. And this is something that the pro-abortion industry doesn't seem to want to talk about either. If you even look, sometime, if you're doubtful of that question, Google, how do you manage a pregnancy that has an IUD in place? And what you find is that if the baby comes far enough along to be able to be determined that you're determined pregnant, most of those pregnancies do dismally. They get infected, they bleed. That's because the IUD is interfering in the womb. The way it works is it sets up an inflammation inside the lining of the womb, and it prevents implantation. So it prevents the embryo that's coming down the tube from implanting in the womb. So effectiveness is not the only question that someone who cares about embryos has to ask. They also have to ask, what's the effect on the embryo that's conceived, if there is an embryo conceived?
Then with about a minute here, how do we correct the disinformation campaign that now surrounds pregnancy post-Roe?
Well, the best thing to do is to go to the website of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. We have a lot of information, very accurate information, that many of us have been working on for decades to give an accurate picture of what is the truth about reproduction and about some of the questions surrounding abortion. You'll find lots and lots of information there. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity now that we can finally have this debate in public. It's been squelched for 50 years, but now we can finally talk about what elective abortion really is, and do we want to be killing human beings inside the womb for no medical reason? And I welcome this discussion, and I welcome the opportunity to clear up some of the misinformation that's been around for 50 years.
Dr. Donna Harrison is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, executive director of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, associate scholar at the Charlotte Loser Institute, and author of a column for The Federalist titled OBGYN Fact Checks New York Times Sex Ed Quiz Finds Numerous Errors. You'll find a link to this column and to the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists at issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Dr. Harrison, thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Dr. Carl Vakencher awaits in the on-deck circle as we look forward to Sunday morning, according to the 3-year lectionary. We'll discuss Mary and Martha in Luke chapter 10. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I'm accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.